Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ian Bremmer is our guest this hour. His book is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. Ian writes in the intro of the book is about the emergence of this new strand of capitalism and how it threatens free markets and the future of the global economy. The main characters are the men who rule China, Russia, and the Arab monarchies of the Persian Gulf. But as we'll see in some detail, the apparent success of this new model has attracted imitators throughout much of the developing world. It's the story of how, in the first decade of this new century, public wealth, public investment, and public ownership have made a stunning comeback. Governments dominate key domestic economic sectors. The oil companies they now own control three-quarters of the world's crude oil reserves, and they own enormous investment funds that have quickly become vitally important sources of capital. So we have a lot to talk about. And Ian is the president of Eurasia Group, which is a leading global political risk research and consulting firm. He founded Eurasia Group in 1998 with just $25,000. And today the company has offices in New York, Washington, and London, and a network of experts and resources around the world. He's written extensively. He's also the author of The J-Curve, A New Way to Understand Why Nations Rise and Fall, and The Fat Trail, The Power of Political Knowledge for Strategic Investing. He's a contributor for the Wall Street Journal. He is also a panelist for CNN International's Connect the World and appears regularly on CNBC, Fox News, NPR, and other networks. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Ian. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Ian. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. The book has really taken off. You're all over the place. Is it that you are breaking, that you have something new here, that we like new things, that you're explaining what's going on in the world economy in a different way?
I think it resonates for two reasons, and you're always second-guessing this stuff, but the first is that we've just gone through 2 years of financial crisis and economic recession, and I don't think people are capable of reading another book on how we got crushed with CDOs and too big to fail and all the rest.
Right.
And so the first thing is I think we're just sick of looking at the financial crisis that happened 2 years ago. But the second is people are recognizing that we're emerging from this global recession in a different world. And the challenges are very different, that the free market economies, the United States, Europe, Japan, are under still an enormous amount of stress and pressure. And you look and see who's doing the best, and it's China, and it's Russia, and it's Saudi Arabia. And we've never been in that world before. The system is different, and it creates really new challenges. And I think people want to they intuitively understand it. And I hope that, you know, I'm providing them at least a few interesting thoughts along the way.
Indeed you are. Let's start with China, which still remains a mystery to me in large part. Can you tell us what they have done in terms of introducing free market into their politics and also how the state still has control? I guess I'm asking a broad question is why in the world are they doing as well as they are? What's the combination?
Well, you know, 1.3 billion people under a state that is coherent and organized and is prepared to really leverage market tools for political aims long-term matters. I mean, you have a crisis, and this government can take $600 billion and get it working to stimulate the economy in days. No one else can do that. Add that to the extraordinary productivity gains that you have from labor just coming on board and the infrastructure being built, 60% of the world's new nuclear plants, either under construction or planned, are in China. You go on and on with those sorts of statistics, and you understand that, you know, there's a reason why they're able to continue to produce. But we need to recognize that it's not a free market system, of course. it is a system where rule of law is absent. And it's a system where the state is leveraging markets for political purposes, for their survival long term. And that it's fine if that makes economic sense for everyone. But if it doesn't make economic sense for everyone, but it makes economic and political sense for the state, then that's the way they're going. Mm. And that is becoming a serious challenge for those of us in the developed world.
Mm-hmm. And so they don't have perhaps as many scruples. I don't know what countries do have scruples, but we may find that their companies are locating in questionable parts of the world so they can make deals on oil or whatever it is to benefit the state in China. Forget what's happening with labor conditions or turmoil, political turmoil in other parts of the world, say in African countries.
Well, whether or not you want to call it scruples, I mean, the Chinese would say, look, I mean, we need to industrialize, we need to develop, you've done it, we're doing it however we can. So, without making a strong value judgment, let's just say we're here in the United States, we have rule of law. Our corporations, you know, are forced to work under it or they're penalized. And so, you know, you want to go and do business in Iran, if you're a U.S. company, sorry, you can't do that. You want to go and sort of drill for oil in Sudan, sorry, we're not going to let you do that. Of course, you know, if you're a Chinese corporation, those countries are open to you. And the state, frankly, if they don't own you, they're probably still going to help you do it. And that coordination of a state-managed industrial policy together with the capital behind it has proven to be an advantage that the Chinese government has.
Mm-hmm. And what about their sovereign wealth fund? Can you explain to me how much of the U.S. they own these days and what a sovereign wealth fund is and what kind of funds other countries have?
Well, a sovereign wealth fund is one of the key tools that state capitalist societies use to influence the markets for their benefit. It's basically a pool of capital that the state invests, and not just as they might their reserves in different currency baskets, but they take much more risk. It's much more aggressive. It can be much more strategic and long-term. And so as a consequence, you see in countries like Abu Dhabi and in Russia and in China and other places, as these governments have developed large surpluses, they take large pools of capital and they invest them. And they can invest them domestically. They can invest them internationally. But, of course, they do it focusing not just on economic returns but also on political stability. So if you're Abu Dhabi today, your first priority with your sovereign wealth fund is bailing out Dubai, even if you don't make a lot of money doing that, because that's the political priority of the government.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Norway, Norway being one of those countries that is blessed with an efficiently run democratic and transparent government that also has a national oil company and a sovereign wealth fund. Can you contrast that with a place like Russia?
It certainly can. I think it's important to recognize that state capitalism is about two key things. First, it's about the state being the most important actor in the economy, not the private sector multinational corporations, so what you find in Japan, in Europe, in Canada, and the United States. The second is the absence of rule of law. And so, you know, with the transparency in a country like Norway, the fact that if you fall afoul of the rules, even if the state happens to like you, there's a judiciary that's independent. There are lawyers. The United States, back when AIG had $165 million of bonuses, we were very angry here in America, and rightly so. And Obama was outraged, and Congress was outraged. But, you know, after they thought about it, they recognized they weren't going to rip those bonuses up. And the reason for that is because they would have been caught in lawsuits for decades. In state capitalist societies, you don't get lawyered up. You get Googled out. You know, and when Google had some problems locally with Baidu, they didn't call their lawyers. They tried to work it out behind the scenes with the Chinese government. When they couldn't do it, they left. Mm-hmm. And that is the option for corporations that fall afoul of governments in state capitalist systems.
Mm. And what about in places like the United States, where the state has had to, because of the possible collapse of an entire system, become the most important actor in the game?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when Obama first came in office, I remember him saying directly that the U.S. economy faces catastrophe if Washington doesn't get this right. And that's sending a very clear message. It's not Wall Street, and Lord knows it's not Main Street. It's K Street, and it's what the government does that will determine whether or not the U.S. gets through this crisis. But we need to recognize that even with that in place, the importance, perhaps the overimportance, of corporate lobbies in the United States and their influence over Democrats and Republicans in Congress, their influence over the White House, their influence in the Supreme Court, which is very well disposed towards the private sector, the existence of rule of law, all of these things mean that, you know, not only is Obama not a socialist, but Obama is not a state capitalist. Overwhelmingly, private sector multinational corporations are the dominant economic actors in the U.S. They will continue to be. The question will be, is our government going to continue to keep its eye off the ball? Because the U.S. has really not regulated a lot of industries well at all. The notion of self-regulation of banks and the problems you got with the mortgage crisis is almost identical to the lack of regulation of oil drilling and the problem that we now have in BP. And how many times are we going to have to go through this before we start learning the lesson that we need appropriate regulatory oversight?
Well, do you think, at least in the oil industry example, we have learned a lesson?
I think that we are taking it now seriously. And certainly you're going to see much more scrutiny of offshore drilling. But what's the next thing? I mean, you know, I was watching the CEO of BP, Tony Hayward, come out and make all these statements in the early days about how it wasn't that big of a deal and how the ocean was really big. And I don't believe he's an idiot. And I also don't believe that he's a complete liar. I think that he really didn't know how bad it could be. It was an enormous failure of risk management, an unconscionable failure of risk management. Well, now in the United States, we have corporations that are developing unconventional gas, and they're going to make a huge amount of money. What's the next mistake they're going to make there? I'm sure that we will get this one mistake right, and I'm sure in terms of derivatives and CDOs on CDOs and all the stuff that we've been reading about for the last 2 years, that we will get that specific problem in the financial industry right. But that's not going to save us from the next problem. We need proper regulatory oversight with people that are well compensated and that are capable and that are also not exposed to massive pressure from lobbying organizations.
Well, it also seems to me that it requires a change in philosophy of some of these companies, that short-term gain was something that was just too tempting. You made a whole lot of money with short-term gain. Who cares about risks?
You know, Kathleen, I'm really glad you raised that because, you know, the extremes have these two problems. If you are a unregulated private sector entity, the problem is not that you're not focused on profit. The problem is that you're focused on short-term profit. You've got to make your numbers every quarter for your shareholders, and you've got to make sure that your CEO is compensated more than Croesus and all of the rest. And that's the problem of, you know, sort of an un- or under-regulated free market system. A state capitalist system does not have that problem. It has a different problem, which is that it's not a focus on economic growth and stability long term. It's a focus on making sure that an authoritarian government stays in power no matter what. And that can work perfectly well as long as the politics and the economics are aligned. But if they don't, the politics trump. Mm. And that's just as bad for the economy, and it's just as bad for the people.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Ian Bremmer is our guest this hour. His book is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. the first thing I wanted to say is that I believe that the term free market is a misnomer, that our economic policy has been pretty consistent throughout our history since the Spanish War in 1898, the principle being penetration of other economies in the world, ordinarily with the use of military force. That has continued and intensified, I think, after the Second World War. The government policy and the policy of our corporations have been largely coherent in that regard. I think one of the bases for state capitalism or state economies is a defense against that sort of thing, and you've seen examples now in Venezuela, Bolivia, in the fact that Argentina resisted our debt and things like that. But the main problem, I think, is that the principle behind capitalism in general is growth. And that growth requires continuous economic growth, and that growth depends upon expansion of the population base to consume that growth. And we have gone, I think it is quite clear, beyond the carrying capacity of our environment. That happened quite a while ago, and that recognition is now intensified by our realization that global warming is going to cause massive effects in all of the economies of the world. And I rather think that what we're going to be looking at is a meeting place between Karl Marx and Mother Nature.
All right, a lot there, Ian.
Well, you know, the easiest thing to disagree with, and I'm sympathetic to what's behind it, which is that state capitalism is a reaction to capitalism that has provided a lot of wealth for Western multinationals and not necessarily provided a lot of trickle down for folks in Venezuela. In fact, the initial growth of state capitalism, national oil corporations, came as a reaction to Western multinationals that were making lots of money drilling in countries that are now part of OPEC. So sure, but let's be very clear. He said that the problem with free market capitalism is growth. State capitalism has a bigger problem with growth than free market capitalism does. I'm very sympathetic to the fact that we're probably, as a world economy, not going to be able to grow the way we have, and climate change is just the beginning of that, with population issues and all the rest. But China, if the Chinese don't grow at 8, 9, 10% a year, the authoritarian Chinese regime faces a threat to its survival. If the United States doesn't grow, people can vote the American government out, but you still have Congress. You'll still have the Supreme Court. In China, you're talking about the system. So if you want to talk about sustainability, and it sounds like your caller really wants to, sadly, we're not moving in a direction of compromise. The growth of state capitalism moves us even farther towards unsustainable growth, and I think it's a challenge we need to meet head on.
And where is China now? 10% growth?
10 plus. If you look plus. At the export numbers over just the last 24 hours, the last quarter I think was 11.6. They're knocking the cover off the ball, but they're also degrading their own environment to a degree that the world has never seen before in a large economy, and they feel like they must continue. And it's not that they don't care about the environment. They are building, of course, lots of alternative energy. They're supported for creating green jobs, but their highest priority is political survival and the economic growth that is required for that. And that means that they're going to be emitting more coal emissions and all of the rest. 75% of their electricity is still going to be coming from coal, even once they build all of their nuclear reactors in the next 20 years. And this is the biggest problem that the world is facing.
What are they doing with cars? Somebody was telling me this week that they have much more fuel-efficient cars.
They are moving towards more fuel efficiency, but of course the numbers are daunting. China, as of last year, is a larger market for automotive consumption than the United States is. And the general feeling is, you know, you get your refrigerator, you get your television, then you want a moped. The next big thing you want is a car. And, you know, there are 1.3 billion people in China. They don't get cars. And it's not because they're bad people. It's just because there's 1.3 billion of them. And no one is prepared to tell them that, but it's just not sustainable. I mean, their view is, look, you and the West got to industrialize, and your corporations made all this money off of our back, and now we want to. And the world's not going to tolerate it. And I don't mean America. I mean the world we live on.
Hmm. Thanks, Richard, for your call. Jordan from Marengo. Hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I'd like to address the fact that it seems to me the almost propaganda-oriented talking points that we get from the right, you know, say, oh, government can't do anything right, you know, but if you look at some of the agencies like NOAA or USGS that operate without really lobbying interference, they do really great work that provides a lot of information and services for free to industries that really, you know, make industry more efficient, really. And, you know, you take a look at something like the EPA, where, you know, industry sends lobbyists in to specifically corrupt the effectiveness of those agencies, then the right wing can say, oh, great, look, see, these agencies fail, government doesn't work, therefore government can't do anything right. You know, so it becomes this kind of self-serving talking point thing, you know, kind of like they're still saying, well, economic high tide rises all boats. Well, you know, guess what? That's not really working out for a lot of us, you know, who work for a living either, you know. And my final suggestion is that, you know, I've been paying a lot of attention to this new constitutionalism coming from the Tea Party and stuff, and I don't really see anywhere in the Constitution that it says the nation should be run as a winner-take-all corporatocracy, really. You know what? We can't let companies run the nation, really. You know, we don't elect them. You know, we elect the government, and that's what the Revolutionary War was fought for, was, you know, the government. So,
okay, let's get a response. Ian?
There's no question that the power of corporate lobbies combined with this almost messianistic belief that companies can regulate themselves, most particularly banks, with Alan Greenspan and the rest, has proven desperately wrong. And it needs to be redressed. And you know, Greenspan, for me, is a villain in all of this. I mean, you know, he came out and he basically said, mea culpa, and then we didn't hear from him for months. And, you know, frankly, when this all went down, I would have liked to have seen him front and center, especially because he was so lionized by folks that believed in the free markets. I mean, really out there offering his support with Paulson, saying, I will work with you to get this right. I got it wrong. And, you know, he was more than happy to be in front of the media when he took millions for his book, but not when it all came crashing down around him. But I also think we need to recognize, let's not go too far in this direction. It's not as if the United States holds its policy only because corporates want it to. I mean, if that were the case, then American companies would be dominating Iraq right now. You talk to any CEO of an American corporation on the oil side, they can't stand Obama. Obama's not exactly, he wasn't supporting oil to a great degree, even before BP came, never mind now. I mean, Sarkozy in France was much more effective in bringing a bunch of corporates over to Baghdad and say, here, we're gonna go and develop this industry. The U.S. doesn't do industrial policy and industrial strategy the way that, say, the Japanese do or the way that the Germans do. And so what ends up happening is you get the worst kind of lobbying, which is lobbying that is knee-jerk, that is often done at the local level with congressmen, and it gets you ineffectual policy that's not in any way strategic. And I think that that combination is part of the thing that needs to be addressed.
Thank you, Jordan, for the call. Here's an email from Madison. Is the current system more like early modern capitalism, Georgian Britain and the East, Indian Company, and Tsarist Russia? This is the system critiqued by Adam Smith, rigged and ultimately unstable.
I actually write about that in the book. The emailer is referring to mercantilism. In fact, I remember when I was on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart at the end, he actually joked, said, so we should just all go back to mercantilism. And state capitalism has some of its origins in that, with the East India Trading Company and the rest. The differences are that you really didn't have a market-based system for running the economy. There was no sense of free trade. There wasn't a belief that trade could rise all boats. There was an enormous focus on trying to hoard gold on the part of state reserves, and it was seen in a very zero-sum sort of way, very different from a much more advanced economy that we have today. But mercantilism, that system, was a precursor of the state capitalism that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to those growth figures for a moment. The biggest growth is happening where, and where does the U.S. stand in this?
The biggest growth in the world today of the major economies is happening in China.
It is China.
And beyond that, it's Russia. It's a lot of emerging markets in around Asia, countries like India, Vietnam, Cambodia. You see strong growth in the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, commodities producers on the basis of relatively high commodities prices, particularly high oil prices, are doing well right now. Who's doing badly? Japan, Europe, in, you know, differentiated across Europe, but Europe, the Eurozone as a whole, is in parlous condition. The U.S. is probably doing better than any of the major developed states, but it's still very anemic. The only countries in the developed world that are doing really well right now are Australia and Canada, not as exposed on the financial crisis side, also very strong commodities players.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about Russia. We haven't centered on Russia. And we assume that after the fall of communism, nobody knew what the heck to do in Russia. The black market was thriving. There was chaos. They're doing pretty well. How did that happen?
Well, the thing that happened after the Soviet Union fell is there was an immediate sense of, okay, let's give these guys shock therapy and let's support moving a free market in as fast as possible. And the structure, the institutional structure, wasn't right for it. The state was very, very powerful. There was no rule of law. So what you got was a bunch of well-connected kleptocrats that came in, oligarchs. They built the government and the people for billions and billions of dollars. They made off with it. They stole everything that wasn't locked down, and the economy was in crisis. Then Putin came in, and they turned it around. They said, well, if that's democracy, if that's the free market, we want none of it. And so as a consequence, today what you see is a country that has more power consolidated in the hands of one person than almost any other major economy in the world. And Putin, I believe that Putin is probably the most powerful individual in the world today.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of one person. I mean, Obama has a much more powerful country, but Obama's ability to get policy done, I mean, how long did health care take, right? I mean, Putin's not sitting around a year to get health care done, I promise you. And so as a consequence, you have an extraordinary consolidation of power that is taking advantage of a lot of natural resources. It's a big country. It's a wealthy country. They've got oil. They've got gas. They've got timber. They've got a lot of precious metals. As climate change works for them with the melting of the polar cap, they're going to have more ports, and they're going to have more resources to exploit, transport waterways. They have some problems. There's no question. Lots of folks are very reluctant to invest long term there because there's no transparency and there's huge corruption locally, and their population is shrinking pretty quickly. So long term, the ability of the Russia to maintain a strong and vibrant consumer base is going to be pretty limited.
Right. Let's go to Todd from Waupun next. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, we've seen the result of deregulation. It's most visible, obviously, in the petroleum industry today and the banking industry. But and it only becomes visible once these industries become in trouble. I work in the telecommunications industry and have seen the results of deregulation there. But I really don't. I'm wondering if we will ever see corporations go back, or the government go back to a more heavily regulated structure for all corporations to make sure that they're playing by the rules.
I don't know about all corporations because, you know, again, it's such a big and diverse economy, and the government tends to be reactive. So, you know, it's you see how difficult it is to get, you know, sort of individual pieces of policy through. There are so many moving pieces. The American political system is really structured to work very well in periods of growth and in periods of relative stability, so that you could vote in someone who is a complete wacko, and they wouldn't be able to accomplish very much. They couldn't destroy the system because there are lots of checks and balances. But that also means that if you move towards deregulation over a period of decades, it's hard to move to consistent regulation in a year. It's going to take a long time. Even on the financial side, I think it'll be 3 to 5 years before we see the full impact and the full slate of legislation as the SEC and the other organizations, you know, get staffed up and people try to understand what those new powers mean and how they react to them and the rest. I do think that one place we're going to see more regulation coming down the road will probably be around technology, in part because it's changing so quickly, in part because people are trying to understand privacy issues, what it means to have control over so much data, and how that influences other sectors, how it influences banking, deals, and the rest. So I think that across the board, you're going to see interesting moves by the U.S. government to really take this on. How effective it'll be, open to question.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the call. We go next to Brad in were you in, Brad?
Hi, I'm here.
Okay, hi, Brad.
Yeah, I think it's fine for some things to be subject to a regulated free market, such as consumables, like if you're going to buy a TV or a pair of water skis. But then other things, I think, should be more part of our commons, such as healthcare, which I don't think should be subjected to that for-profit-driven principle. And I wonder what your guest thinks about that.
I generally agree with that. I mean, look, you look even at things like national security and bombs and rockets. I mean, that's not a free market. The United States doesn't let Lockheed Martin sell their advanced stuff to enemies of the U.S. They're going to sell it to the United States with security guarantees, and they're going to sell slightly worse stuff to the Israelis, the Egyptians, the Turks, the Brits, and the like. I think with things that are critical for the public betterment, in the United States, you're going to have more both governmental oversight and, in some cases, more direct governmental involvement. But my point is that the principal economic actor, you know, sort of in terms of the growth of the economy and in terms of the general GDP, is still going to remain the private sector in the U.S. and the multinational corporation. But there's no question at all. Underlying your question is that if the government takes its hands off the steering wheel completely, the commons are going to be destroyed. I think that is absolutely right, and it speaks for one of the key roles that the U.S. government has played historically and should continue to play.
And thanks very much for your call. You're right. You talk about the growth in the global economy, 150% in the global economy from 60 to 2000 or 80, between 80 and 19 in 2007. The growth have created, you say, rising expectations that over the long term, only free markets can meet. Why only free markets can meet them?
I'm not even sure free markets can meet them. But only free markets will have a shot at meeting those expectations because of the lack of efficiency of state capitalist systems. And see, the problem, ultimately, I think that the free market is a better bet, or perhaps as Winston Churchill would say, it's the worst economic system out there except for all the others. And I say that because the most successful example of state capitalism in China is because of its support, its political support for Chinese enterprises, Western corporations increasingly won't be bringing their technology there. And so the Chinese are going to have to do it increasingly themselves. State capitalism is not a global ideology. It's a statist ideology. Mm-hmm. It supports China, and it supports Russia. and it will support countries that are completely and utterly dependent on them, client-state relationships with some others in Asia, for example, and maybe some commodity producers in sub-Saharan Africa. But long-term, you need to be working together with other countries and other industries all over the world, and state capitalism will inhibit that. And the Chinese system will not be well put together to do it themselves. Their educational system, much more focused on rote. Their governmental and economic system is much more focused on bureaucratic management. It's not as flexible. It's not as entrepreneurial. And so great for manufacturing things, but as we move towards service and information technology and new technologies that heretofore haven't been discovered yet, they're going to run into trouble. And they're going to run into trouble while they're destroying their environment. Mm. And so ultimately, we're going to go through a rough patch here in the U.S., and the Europeans and Japanese even more so. The next 5-10 years, this is going to be really hard, and I think this issue of state capitalism is going to become the primary one that we're addressing, that we're struggling with. But long term, if you have to make a bet, you'd still bet on a properly regulated free market.
Tom is driving in western Wisconsin. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hi. I always like driving through Wisconsin because there's always something good on WPR to listen to, something
good.
Challenging. And, you know, you hear a lot about sustainable growth, and you mentioned it earlier. I suppose there's really no such thing because resources have limits, and then growth by definition can't be sustainable. But what happens next? I mean, what does a no-growth economy look like?
Well, a no-growth economy, if it's global, is going to have some interesting political implications. So, first of all, there are some countries that are already experiencing this, some of the ones that are recognizing that they're in serious crisis right now. You look at Greece. You look at Spain. You look at Portugal. Look at what Latvia just had to go through. These guys are going to see contraction of their GDPs, a minimum of 10% over the next few years. They have been spending money that they do not have. They are facing massive solvency issues, and they're going to have to engage in fiscal restrictions that they've never dealt with before in the modern era. And so what does that look like? Well, that's going to make governments more brittle. It's going to lead to more social instability, and it's going to be very hard. Infrastructure is going to degrade. A lot of people aren't going to want to invest. That's in Europe. But in a country like China, you know, a long-term, maybe even a short or medium-term no-growth environment creates insurrection. I mean, you know, China, right now, today, the Chinese people are probably, on balance, happier with their government than the Americans are with the American government. And don't even get me started on the Greeks and the Japanese or the Brits. But that's because they've been growing for 30 years at 10% clip because of the state. Now, when that stops happening, then the support for the Chinese government is going to erode immensely, and you're going to have a Tiananmen Square type situation times 10, times 100. And that's the concern. As I mentioned before, if a low or no growth environment is really, really hard and unwelcome in the West, it is a disaster for the state capitalists. And we need to recognize that. And that's why the Copenhagen Summit on Climate Change fell apart, because they know that. They understand what they're facing if they actually engage in the kind of long-term emissions reductions that are utterly required so we can continue to live with anything remotely like our present living standards on this planet. But, you know, try telling that to the government officials that are trying to stay in power.
Ian Bremmer is our guest this hour. His book is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations? More emails and phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ian Bremmer is our guest, and here's a good email for you, Ian. This one comes from John. The growth imperative was mentioned by one caller, but you found the concern valuable only in the context of your focus on state capitalism. Form is pretty irrelevant if the polar ice caps melt. You haven't talked about the economy of China dependent on the health of the U.S. economy. It's an export economy, and if Americans are losing their jobs because they're exporting to China, then they don't have the incomes necessary to buy the same goods that they used to make that are now made in China. These are not idle intellectual points. We are at the end of something, and what comes next is not certain. One thing, though, is that it will not be the cornucopia we have so successfully squandered.
I'm so glad he asked that question, because I agree completely. It's really what's behind the book, that question, which is that, look, the Americans can't buy the Chinese stuff that we used to. We probably shouldn't, by the way, but we certainly can't. Neither can the Europeans. Now, the Chinese aren't stupid. They know this. And again, they're focused on growth, not just in terms of the polarized cap, but I mean much more immediately. They're focused on how are they going to grow if the Americans can't buy their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a strategy. In fact, they have three strategies. And this is a consensus in Beijing. It's pretty extraordinary given the size of the government. Number one, diversify exports away from the West. Number two, engage in indigenous innovation so that you maintain a larger percentage of the profits of the stuff you do manufacture and produce. Number three, develop and expand Chinese domestic consumption. Now, all three of these things are responses to this problem. None of them will happen overnight. The Chinese know it. And there is a fourth strategy. And the fourth strategy, and this is a problematic one, is demonize the West. Because if you think that you might not be able to make it fast enough with these three strategies to deal with the fact that the West can't buy your stuff, blame the dollar as the global reserve currency. Blame the failure of the free market. Blame Google and Goldman Sachs and Western. Goldman Sachs, this week, Chinese state media saying they're making too much money. You know what? They are. The United States says the same thing. When the U.S. says it, Goldman can respond. They have lawyers, all the rest. When the Chinese media says it, you've got a very serious problem.
Lou in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello?
Yes, Lou, go ahead.
Oh, your guest mentioned the gas industry as being a possible problem down the road. Now, that industry is injecting toxic chemicals into the earth to get gas, fracturing rock. I think they call it fracking.
Fracking, yep.
Yeah. My question is that industry out of control yet, or is it still over the horizon?
It's not out of control yet. I think it's nascent. And, you know, here's one of the problems, right? So the United States is going through this recession. And what everyone in the energy industry pretty much agrees is a game changer for global energy this year is this new unconventional gas, this fracking exploration that you talk about, right? And the American corporations dominate it. So here's this great opportunity with lots of money that the Americans are going to have, going to create jobs and all the rest. So you can just imagine how important the lobby is going to be behind all of this. And then we're talking about unproven technology that shoots chemicals into the ground, already talk about potential environmental backlash. It's on the horizon, but it's coming. Now, if our history teaches us anything, it's probably going to be that we're not going to risk manage this well. And so we're going to have the odd problem or two before we get it right. And I'm not saying that means that we should shake our hands in the air and say we shouldn't do anything. I'm just saying this is what I expect will happen.
Anything else, Lou?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the call. Is it you? Terry from Brookfield. Hi, Terry.
Hey, guys. Two quick points. My first point is, you know, we're talking a lot about regulation, and, you know, that seems fine, but I just wanted to see what your guests would comment on our current regulatory bodies. It seems to me we've had two examples recently with the SEC and obviously the financial collapse. We found out that the SEC, a large majority of their employees, literally were surfing porn during the day. You know, with the MMS here, you know, we're now focusing everything on them. Well, we've seen that they're basically friends with everybody in the oil industry. I mean, you know, they're going to fishing tournaments together. They're having sex with each other. I'm sorry to be so, you know, upfront there. But to me, there's no accountability in these governmental bodies. And I don't care if it's a Republican administration, a Democratic administration. So for me to add more government jobs, add more regulatory bodies where nobody ever gets fired, there's no consequences. At least in the private market, if you have a product that fails, you're out of business. There's no accountability for if something fails in the government. People can't even get fired, and that's one of my main concerns. It's almost like we need something to regulate the regulators in the government.
Ian.
It wasn't clear from your caller as to whether he thought the surfing or the porn or the having sex with folks in the industry was worse. They're both problematic. Of course, you know, Lord knows what they're doing in the private sector at the same time. I think that the part of the problem we have in government oversight is that these people are not compensated properly. And so as a consequence, the folks that are going into these jobs frequently are people that want the job stability. They want the benefits. It's not always the case. You know, if you look in the foreign section of our government, you look at the State Department, you know, you see a lot of people, mid-level, high-level, low-level, that actually see that they're serving their country and trying to make a difference in the way America is perceived in the world. It's a lot of idealism, and sometimes it's a little evangelical. But these are quality, intelligent people. And yet, I got to tell you, the folks that are talking about the SEC, you just don't get that. And I think that unless you have a mission that really appeals to people, and it's not clear that the SEC's mission is ever going to be as sexy as talking about, you know, sort of representing American foreign policy around the world, then you're going to need to pay them. You're going to need to pay them, and you're going to need to put in accountability. I mean, one of the things that we need to do is really fix HR in the U.S. government. And that's something, actually, I've been disappointed with Obama on. You know, when Obama first came in, you know, with one of the Daschle that he was trying to get in as Secretary of Health, and it didn't happen. And then after that, he said, okay, that's it. We're going to look at everyone. We're going to scrutinize everyone to make sure that we're not going to have any more crises, any more scandals coming in. He didn't have any more crises. Instead, he couldn't fill positions for a year. What he should have said is, we need this government filled now. We're not going to scrutinize people to the degree that no one any good is ever going to want to apply. We're going to put reasonable standards in place. We're going to pay these people properly, and we're going to get them in now. That's the part of the U.S. government that needs to run like the private sector, is hiring the best and the brightest. And frankly, our government just doesn't work that way.
Thanks, Terry. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
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 Okay. I was wondering, I heard there's this movement to repeal the laws that allow corporations to be treated like people in terms of their liability. That's kind of how I understand it. And, you know, it might be ridiculous. I mean, you might think this would never get passed, but I'm just wondering how that would change this whole free market idea picture that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I agree on both points in the sense that, one, I can't imagine it would ever pass, in the sense that limited liability is one of the reasons why corporations can get set up and get funded and all the rest. I mean, if it did, it would obviously massively undermine competitiveness. Very different from, of course, reducing the liability of something, you know, sort of on the insurance liability and the rest around the oil drilling, which, of course, BP has waived. But, I mean, that piece of legislation is coming down the pike. And that will reduce drilling, there's no question.
Can you factor in to the, I don't know how to ask this, I'm thinking about a couple things. One is a lot that we've heard about the cost of labor and so many U.S. corporations going elsewhere to get to labor that's cheaper. And I'm also thinking at the same time of the companies who've been paying $1 million, $7 million and above bonuses to financial companies because they have to keep their talent or they go elsewhere. And I keep wondering where the heck else are you going to go. Can you take on the issue of inequality in wages and how it relates to this short-term need for profit? And can you make a question out of that for me?
I mean, I can try to address it a little. I mean, you know, keep in mind that, you know, inequality of wages in terms of global manufacturing is changing. You can have all sorts of governmental sort of positions in place and that, you know, you think about the lack of competitiveness of American automotive companies because of the importance of labor and because of the benefits they got that drove wages up to the point that they just, no one was going to want to produce cars in the U.S., and that industry is going away, whether the U.S. supports it or not. But even in China, the China price is going up. You see that with what's happening with the Foxconn factories right now. I mean, people are demanding, in some cases, 2/3 salary increases, which are already above market standards. They're going to get them. and you're not going to have anywhere else to go. So prices are going up as parts of the developing world are surely industrializing. Perhaps the more interesting question is on the high side, because there is massive disparity in executive compensation, and a lot of that seems to still be oriented towards short-termism. I mean, you compare what a Japanese executive makes, a CEO, to what the average American makes, and it's laughable how much less these people make. And yet, you know, there's enormous amounts of loyalty to these firms, and they stick with them for a very long time. In the United States, there's a great deal more fluidity, and at the top, people get compensated much, much more highly. And I suspect as we start to see limits on growth, one of the places that will end up getting hit the most in some of these companies is going to be the top-line executive pay.
Mm. Can you do this in 30 seconds? What about tariffs? China taxes U.S. imports over 20%. USA places tariffs of only 2 to 3% on their stuff. What do you think of tariffs?
I fear that greater tariffs are coming. We see Geithner talking even today about more pressure on the Chinese to move their currency. They're not going to move their currency unless they want to, and it's not going to be 25%. It's going to be more like 3% when they do. I think Congress is gearing up for those tariffs. The more tit for tat you see, the more eventually the Americans are going to get hit, because the one thing we do need to recognize is we are still the world's largest economy with the biggest multinational corporations, and so therefore tariffs are going to ultimately hit us more than they hit anybody else.
All right, Ian, thank you so much. Wonderful guest. Ian Bremmer, our guest. The book is The End of the Free Market: Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations? Haven't had enough of Ian. He's going to be on Point tonight at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Ian is the president of Eurasia Group, a leading global public or leading global political risk research and consulting firm. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee offices. Great conversation ahead. I'm going to be on vacation for a little while, so I'll return. Next week is in great hands, so I'll be back a week from Monday for all things political. Thank you for listening. This is the Ideas Network.